a mixed message to Tehran today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Threats and sanctions on the one hand, willingness to talk on the other. Some Iranians say Washington is sending them mixed messages.
Then for the Iranians, the United States is not sincere.
Also, why Border Patrol facilities where migrant children are held are often compared to ice boxes or dog kennels.
Gives you an idea of how people feel when they're inside of them. They either feel like they're being frozen to death or they feel like they're being boxed into literal cages.
Plus, an open-air university in New York where all the professors are immigrants who sacrificed their careers when they came here.
And most of them never, ever have the opportunity to teach their subjects.
Those stories and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. There's no question U.S. policy in the Middle East is all over the news agenda today. Just take a scan of where in the world you'll find top U.S. officials. National Security Advisor John Bolton is in Israel. White House Senior Advisor Jared Kushner is in Bahrain. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was just in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. In just a few days, President Trump himself will be at the G20 summit in Japan, where some key sidebar conversations are expected. And everywhere, everyone's focus is on Iran. Iranian officials had disparaging words today for the U.S. after Trump announced more sanctions specifically on the Ayatollah himself. We reached out to Dr. Zainab Hassami Tari at the University of Tehran to hear how all this looks to Iranians themselves.
Well, the situation seems very complicated because Iranians saying that they have gone through this intensive negotiations for almost 2 years under Rouhani for this nuclear deal. For Iranians, it seems that the U.S. should come back to the JCPOA and its side of the bargain because Iranians have been sticking to their side of the bargain.
So if the U.S. doesn't come back to the negotiating table, and that seems to be the way things are right now, is there something Iran could do to perhaps restart diplomacy?
I think Iranians are trying to keep the diplomacy. However, there are these mixed messages coming from Washington. For the Iranians, it seems that the United States is not sincere. Before the JCPOA, there was this feeling that Iran should start direct negotiations with the United States. However, the public opinion now are becoming very pessimistic that the U.S. is not going to stick to its promises. There is no trust. It seems that Iran is actually trying to invest on other partners who were involved in these negotiations, like European countries, Russia and China. The other partners should actually work hard and fulfill their promise and do whatever they can to actually lift the sanctions.
There are some American lawmakers, as you may know, Dr. Tari, who are talking about regime change and even bombing your country. How are you feeling and what are you hearing from your friends in Tehran? Any worry or anxiety?
I think in the last 2 weeks, there are concerns over the situation, that things are getting very tough. So I hear from my colleagues when they say that they are concerned that something would get out of control and all of a sudden we are going to have a direct conflict.
Dr. Tari, as I said, you teach American studies at the University of Tehran. What are you hearing from your students and what are you telling them right now about this very tense moment in Iranian-U.S. relations?
Now, I think there is a sense of resentment toward the United States. Most of the students had very positive view toward the U.S. culture, literature, and cinema. However, there is this unfavorable view toward the United States government. This was different during the Obama administration because Obama was very successful in creating this image of the U.S. trying to resolve all these issues. However, now with Trump administration, it has affected the way students look at the future.
Dr. Tari, if you had a few minutes to sit down in a room with Washington officials like Senator Tom Cotton or National Security Advisor John Bolton, what would you tell them?
I would say that if the idea is that you put pressure on ordinary Iranians to get them raised against their government, this is not going to work. 30 years, we have gone through different phases of sanctions, though this one is the most severe, the most crippling one. Also, I would refer to some personal experiences. I know some of students as well as friends who are suffering from cancer and they cannot get the medicine they need due to sanctions. It's like a terrorism against vulnerable Iranians and it's not going to have the outcome they are looking for.
Dr. Zainab Hassami Tari is an assistant professor of American Studies at the University of Tehran. She's been speaking with us from Tehran. Dr. Tari, thank you very much for your thoughts.
Thank you for having me.
For the past 11 days, British citizen Richard Ratcliffe has been on a hunger strike outside the Iranian embassy in London. Ratcliffe is protesting the imprisonment of his wife, Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, who was arrested of espionage in 2016. Nazanin is a British-Iranian citizen and was visiting her parents in Iran with her young daughter when she was detained. She has always denied the charges, but an Iranian court sentenced her to 5 years in prison. From London, here's the world's Orla Barry.
Richard Ratcliffe sits on a folding chair on the sidewalk outside the Iranian embassy. It's in a ritzy part of London. Ratcliffe's eyes are bloodshot, and almost 2 weeks without food and sleeping in a tent has started to take its toll.
Feeling quite tired now, to understate it. I think probably the last couple of days I've felt the effects more and more. I'm sort of tired, slower thinking, slower responding.
Ratcliffe began his hunger strike on the same day that his wife Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe began one of her own in a prison in Tehran. It's her second hunger strike. This time, though, Richard decided to join her because he believes that doing it outside the Iranian embassy in London would attract more attention. And he's right. There's a constant stream of visitors. The news media, politicians, supporters and curious members of the public and embassy staff aren't happy.
I don't think I expected the level of hostility from the Iranian embassy. Perhaps not surprising, but I didn't expect them to erect a wall and to try and drive us off the street and call the police and all the rest of it.
The fence the embassy has erected is not having the desired effect. Supporters have plastered it with messages of love for Richard and Nazanin Ratcliffe, along with newspaper articles about the case. The police are friendly too, and have promised Ratcliffe's mother, Barbara, they would watch over her son if he becomes sick. Barbara Ratcliffe spends most of her days here.
I feel very proud of him, overawed by the support he's getting and we're getting, but equally as worried about his health.
On the sidewalk alongside Barbara and Richard is Monique Villa. She's former CEO of the Thomson Reuters Foundation, where Nazanin worked as a project manager when she was arrested. That was at Tehran Airport in April of 2016.
I was taken aback because she was with her baby. If you know, they say she's a spy. If you're a spy, you don't go with your toddler to see your parents. I was absolutely convinced she's not spy material. She's really not.
That toddler, Gabriella, is now 5 and lives with Nazanin's parents in Tehran. The case has become caught up in British politics. The two men, running to be the next leader of the Conservative Party and the next Prime Minister, both have connections to the case. Jeremy Hunt is the British Foreign Secretary, and just yesterday his office issued the latest appeal to the Iranian authorities to free Nazanin. Running against Hunt and the favourite to become Prime Minister is Boris Johnson. Johnson has been widely criticised for inaccurate comments he made about Nazanin when he was Foreign Secretary.
When you look at what Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe was doing, it's just, you know, she was simply teaching people journalism, as I understand it.
The Ratcliffe family strenuously denied she was training Iranian journalists. Later, Johnson retracted the statement. But the official news media in Iran used it to wage a campaign against Nazanin. Increased tensions between Iran and the US are likely not helping matters. Ratcliffe says if Iran feels under siege, it could make it harder to reach any compromise with Britain. I ask his mother, Barbara, what she thinks will happen next.
I like to hope what's going to happen is we get our girls back and life goes on normally again.
From his vantage point on the sidewalk outside the Iranian embassy, Richard Ratcliffe is taking each day as it comes. He says it's up to his wife Nazanin to decide when their joint hunger strike comes to an end.
So we'll only keep going as long as she wants.
And you will then follow that?
That's right, I'll decamp. I mean, it depends when the phone call comes, but my job is to support her. It's not to be on permanent hunger strike.
But there's no sign this is changing any minds in Iran. The Iranian Foreign Ministry this week once again dismissed an appeal for Nazanin's release. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
The interim head of Customs and Border Protection is out. John Sanders had been acting commissioner of CBP for 2 months. He's expected to leave in early July, according to news reports. The move comes amid outcry over conditions in a detention facility in Texas where migrant children were being held, conditions that were described as inhumane by the attorneys who witnessed them. Aura Bogado has covered these issues as an investigative reporter with our partners at the PRX program Reveal. I wanted to know where this is all headed.
It's hard to know if anything is necessarily going to change. I am surprised, as someone who's been reporting on the conditions in these places for so many years, that there really is so much attention being given to them now. And I think that the more people learn, perhaps the more likely it will be that this administration will move to change those policies. But it's really hard to know.
Well, before news of Sanders' resignation, the other big story was those 300 migrant children being removed from a Border Patrol facility in Texas. Conditions had been described there as appalling, no toothpaste, no soap. And then 100 or so of them were returned there because there was no room for them at this other center. What is going on at that facility that's been under scrutiny, and what does it say about the larger picture of how the Trump administration has been handling these children?
These Border Patrol facilities, for migrants, they're usually referred to as hieleras, which are ice boxes, or perreras, which are sort of dog pounds or dog kennels. And that gives you an idea of how people feel when they're inside of them. They either feel like they're being frozen to death or they feel like they're being caged in. And so for this particular facility, there seemed to be a worse than normal overcrowding. And as you mentioned, no toothpaste, no soap, there's no beds. The thing is, none of these facilities have those kinds of even basic toiletries. The idea that they're being moved to another facility that's also a Border Patrol facility should also raise some alarm, because the conditions in these places aren't the kinds that you would really, frankly, want your children in.
I mean, it's not exactly new, these facilities and their miserable conditions. You started reporting on this some years ago under the Obama administration. What did you find then? And do you think it's fair to draw comparisons to how previous administrations have handled detention compared to this one?
When we're talking about hieleras in particular, the Border Patrol stations, people under the Obama administration were calling them that. They still call them that under the Trump administration. And I think it is absolutely fair to compare what the places are like, because I, as a reporter, hear the same thing today that I heard 5 years ago, that I heard 8 years ago, that I heard 10 years ago, all from children that have actually experienced this. Some things may indeed be worse, and I don't want to say that several children dying in the span of just a few months, that is absolutely new, and that is unique to the Trump administration. But in terms of the conditions, if we're talking about places where you may not necessarily even have a place to stand, children who are being forced to stay in the same very, very crowded room with women that they're not, you know, adult women that they're not even related to, none of that is new. No toothbrushes, that's been happening. It's not unique to this administration.
Does it seem to you like there's any breakthrough for change? Is there a strong enough demand and action to get adequate care for all of the people being detained right now?
You know, if you had asked me that question a month ago, I probably would have just assumed, no, I don't think so. Because, again, as someone who's been reporting on it so long, made videos, talked to kids, you know, tried everything so that the public would pay attention. People didn't care for a long time. Something does seem to have happened in the last month or so, and particularly in the last week. People seem to really be focused on this and really be paying attention. So perhaps there's a possibility there where I don't think there was one, like I said, even a few weeks ago.
Aura Bogado, an investigative reporter with our partners at Reveal News. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World, a huge field of candidates vying to lead their party in their country. Until recently, that described the Conservative Party in the UK as much as it does the Democrats here in the US. In a moment, we'll preview tomorrow's first debate among 2020 Democratic presidential hopefuls. First, though, to the UK, where the Conservatives have narrowed their race to two men, front-runner Boris Johnson and challenger Jeremy Hunt. They will not be meeting in a head-to-head TV debate, however.
Tuesday, June the 25th, and the man who has been described as a coward, as pathetic, as trying to sneak into the back door, is still currently the leader in the running to become the leader of the Conservative Party and indeed the Prime Minister. I speak of Boris Johnson, who's opposite me right now. Are you a coward?
Good morning, Nick. Well, yeah. Listen,
I love British interviews. That's broadcaster Nick Ferrari on talk radio station LBC opening an interview with Boris Johnson today. The coward accusation comes after Johnson refused a Sky News invitation to debate Jeremy Hunt tonight. Johnson told LBC, one debate does not a campaign make.
Why have you dodged tonight's debate?
Well,
I'm doing
16 hustings. I've already done several with Jeremy, and look forward to doing many, many more.
All right. Okay.
And I'm doing several TV debates.
No surprise, Jeremy Hunt is disappointed and started using the hashtag BojoNoShow. Hunt says it's disrespectful to voters for Johnson not to debate tonight when Brexit and the future of the country are on the line.
Because in 2 weeks' time, those ballot papers, the postal ballots, are going to arrive through people's letterboxes and they're going to vote. So to say, as you know, he said to me last week, I challenge you to the ITV debate, which I'm willing to do, which I immediately accepted. And then it turns out that ITV debate is not happening until after people have received their postal ballots and most people have voted.
It's not the first time Boris Johnson has declined a debate. In an earlier round of the race for Conservative Party leader, Johnson let his podium stand empty on stage next to the five other candidates. This will all be over by July 23rd. That's when the Conservative Party will announce a winner, and either Boris Johnson or Jeremy Hunt will become party leader and the next Prime Minister of the UK. Which leads us back to the U.S., where we're also watching a big field of candidates make their case to lead the Democratic Party and potentially the country. On Wednesday and Thursday nights, 20 of the Democrats running for president will elbow each other for airtime in two nights of debates. The World's Carolyn Beeler covers the environment and joins me now to talk about how the candidates are addressing this critical campaign issue.
Yeah, and Marco, this year I think the news is that they actually are addressing this critical campaign issue.
Climate change is real. It is man-made.
Climate change is real.
It is us.
Climate change is real and caused by human activity.
Right. That was going to be my first question. Is it a critical campaign issue? Because in the past, it has not been.
It is. It's risen to the top of topics that Democratic voters tell pollers they care about. And I think that's for a number of reasons. There have been increasingly damaging storms that scientists are now able to link more conclusively to climate change. Attention surrounding the Green New Deal has been big. I think the sort of push against President Trump's pullout of the Paris Agreement, and also youth activists, including Greta Thunberg, and also the Sunrise Movement, this group of largely young climate activists who staged this very high-profile sit-in in House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's office to really get a lot of attention for the Green New Deal.
We are building an army of young people to stop climate change and create good jobs for our generation.
So all of that has coalesced to make this actually a top campaign issue for the Democrats.
Yeah, and in a way that it has not been before. What does this translate to, though, in terms of actual policy proposals from the candidates?
I think a good place to start answering that question is with Washington Governor Jay Inslee, who is running for president basically to address climate change. It is the core of his platform. And he says the time to address this is now because people are seeing these impacts right now. It's not an issue for the future. It's an issue for now.
You can't deny the floods in the Midwest. I went to Hamburg, Iowa. It was a town founded in 1858. 1858 had never been flooded. Until this year, it's under 8 feet of water. And then the floods came back a month later. You can't deny Miami Beach taxpayers having to pay taxes to raise their roads a foot and a half. So when you go shopping on Miami Beach now, you look down at the shops. It's the weirdest thing. So because people are now seeing this in their own lives, the people are demanding a response.
So Jay Inslee has the most comprehensive and ambitious climate plan of all of the potential candidates. He is calling for net zero carbon emissions by 2045, and he has policy proposals out for everything from agriculture to climate finance to transportation, but he's polling at around 1%. So obviously this voter enthusiasm for talking about climate change does not necessarily make a candidate rocket to the top of the polls.
Yeah, so we could say Governor Inslee is the climate change candidate. What about some of the other candidates? What are they kind of proposing?
So most of the leading candidates back the Green New Deal, this very ambitious economic and environmental plan that calls for very quickly moving off of fossil fuels by increasing green jobs. 18 so far of the leading candidates have signed a pledge not to take campaign donations from fossil fuel interests. And several candidates have developed climate change policies that call for trillions of dollars in green economy investments and zeroing out carbon emissions by around mid-century.
And do those proposals dovetail at all with the Green New Deal, or is everybody kind of proposing their own Green New Deal?
So of the front runners, I can just run quickly through what they're saying. So Bernie Sanders has sort of the most fingerprints on the Green New Deal, and he's really hitching his cart to that.
I am proud to announce today that I am an original co-sponsor of the Green New Deal proposal. This is a very big deal.
He's saying all in for the Green New Deal. Elizabeth Warren is also a supporter of the Green New Deal, but she, interestingly, instead of having one big climate policy proposal, she is housing her climate policy in the proposals for different sectors, which is sort of a nod to this idea that climate change is not its own issue. It's an issue that's going to impact every aspect of our lives, and thus the solution needs to be within every different sector of our economy. So far, she has three climate plans looking at the military, public land.
On our public lands, there will be no more new drilling or mining.
And jobs in the economy.
So you mentioned Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders. We heard from Governor Jay Inslee. What about Joe Biden? Where does he stand?
So former Vice President Joe Biden was a little bit later to announce his climate plan, but pleasantly surprised activists, I would say, by having it be a very ambitious plan, much more ambitious than the climate change policies that were passed under, you know, when he was in the White House as VP to President Obama, which is a sign of where the Democratic Party has moved on this. Mm. He's calling for, you know, more investment in low carbon energy and resilience infrastructure, like a lot of the other candidates, a carbon tax. And some of his international proposals are interesting, including a kind of carbon tax on imports to make sure we're not offshoring all of our carbon-intensive industries.
What are you going to be listening out for and watching for, Carolyn, in these debates?
So I'm interested in if and how much they actually talk about climate change in these debates. It's on the radar. This debate is in Miami, which had record-breaking heat this week and is also sort of the poster child for sea level rise in the United States. But there has not been a lot of addressing of climate change in past debates. So I'm interested in how much they say, what they say, and what kind of questions they're asked to answer.
The World's Environment reporter, Carolyn Beeler, thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Marco.
And just ahead on the show, what the Democratic candidates have to say about immigration.
Hi, I want to tell you about a new PRX podcast called Things That Go Boom. It's all about foreign policy, but not in the way you might think. At Things That Go Boom, they tell stories about our lives and the world around us in an effort to better understand the ins, outs, and what have yous of what keeps us safe. On the new season, they tell the story of the secret back-channel meetings, political ploys, and even broken bones that led to the Iran nuclear deal. And since President Trump yanked us out of that deal, they ask, are we headed for nuclear war? Things That Go Boom's second season, called Fallout, is available now. Listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. When your job is to moderate content for online platforms, you're exposed to a lot of violent videos and hate speech.
We don't really have a sense or understand what the long-term implications of looking at that kind of stuff day in and day out will be a year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years down the road.
That story coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston.
Miami. South Beach, bringing the heat.
And they will bring the heat. This week, a crowded pool of Democratic candidates heads to, Miami, for their first primetime debates. President Donald Trump has looked to a crackdown on immigration as a rallying point for his reelection bid, and Democratic candidates are fighting back.
Cruelty has failed. I want us to choose compassion.
I believe that immigrants don't diminish America, that they are America.
To tell over a billion Muslims in the world that they are not welcome to come into the United States.
Here to discuss how immigration is playing out among the Democratic candidates and what to expect in this week's debates is The World's Monica Campbell. Hey, Monica.
Hey, Marco.
How are the Democratic candidates positioning themselves on immigration?
Well, there are a lot of candidates, but they're definitely going to hammer away at what we're seeing right now on the border with the kids and how they're being treated on the border. We're going to hear a lot about that.
I went down to the border and I saw where children had been taken away from their mothers.
In our name, little children have been separated from their mothers. People right now...
We do not condone, as an American value, putting children in cages.
President, through cruel policies like family separation, are only getting worse.
Yeah, just a sampling there of some of the opinions on what's happening at the border. That's clearly something candidates will be quick to address, Monica. But immigration, it's a massive thing. It's more than just a border issue and detention centers. What else are they proposing?
Well, they're very consistent on immigration this time around. Most are pushing comprehensive immigration reform. And they're saying right out of the gate, they'll quickly reverse what Trump has done on immigration. So they'll restore DACA for, you know, so-called dreamers and expand it. They'll restore the number of refugees the United States accepts, which right now is rock bottom. They'll get rid of the travel ban. And finally, they're all very vocal about seeing what's going on at the border, what many call a humanitarian crisis, seeing it as a humanitarian crisis and not as a security issue.
Where are there differences among the candidates when it comes to immigration? Are there any bold proposals that stand out?
I mean, you really got to look hard to see where there are nuances. Some proposals are bolder than others. For example, Kamala Harris, the senator from California, she says she would take more unilateral moves, executive orders right out of the gate if she becomes president, making it, for example, easier for some undocumented immigrants to get green cards and a path to citizenship. And Julian Castro, the former mayor of San Antonio and former secretary of HUD, he was out first with the most detailed immigration plan. And it's not surprising, though. He is from Texas, and he's lived this story, an immigrant life, in many ways.
I grew up with a grandmother who came over here from the United States when she was 7 years old from Mexico with her little sister. And they came because their parents had died. And she ended up on the west side of San Antonio. She raised my mom as a single parent. Right? She was basically like a second mother to me. She came here, like I bet a lot of your parents and grandparents did, or maybe some of you have, with hardly anything.
And Castro is proposing to eliminate detention centers and keeping people out of detention centers, except for the most serious cases. And he also wants to decriminalize crossing the border without authorization.
I think it's safe to say that Democratic candidates generally are pro-immigrant and largely were in 2016. Are you seeing any shift, though, from then compared to now?
What I'm seeing is that the candidates are less wishy-washy than in 2016. They're not saying, you know, it's a path toward becoming a legal permanent resident. No, they're saying it's a path to citizenship. So these issues that may have seemed important only to immigrant and immigrant communities are now being seen as candidates as core values, moral tests for the country.
Immigration is your beat, Monica. What are you going to be listening out for in these first debates?
I'll be looking to see how they try and distinguish themselves from one another. It'll be interesting to see if they start to point to each other's voting records and say, you know, you voted for this and that actually drove up deportations under Obama. I'm also interested to see how they will specifically address migration at the border. Right now, I'm seeing them attack how the government is treating migrants at the border. I'd like to hear some more specifics about what they would do.
That's The World's Monica Campbell. Monica, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
The Democratic debates are tomorrow and Thursday nights. We'll be back here discussing the candidates' foreign policy on Friday. Many immigrants living in the United States are overqualified for the jobs they do here. That's according to several studies. It can be hard to get degrees earned in another country recognized here. Or it could also be the lack of connections that come with being born and raised here in the U.S. This summer, the Brooklyn Public Library is trying to reverse that process and is offering a unique al fresco learning experience. Reporter Alina Simone has the story.
Like most of New York City, Prospect Park in Brooklyn is often packed. But the Rose Garden, a grassy hollow built around two old fountains, is an oasis. Today, however, it's walled off by a thick patchwork cloth threaded between large posts. To get inside, you're forced to double back several times. Soon people get frustrated and just start ducking under the barrier. Welcome to America.
It's a metaphor. It's a very poetic metaphor. It speaks to the heart.
Jakob Orzos is with Brooklyn Public Library. And the metaphor he's talking about is the difficulty immigrants face not just getting to America, but making it here. This month, in partnership with the park, the library launches a 3-week pilot program called University Open Air. Free classes on hot-button topics like intersex activism and the immigrant caravans from Central America, taught by experts, meaning
professors, immigrants who came here pretty much giving up their entire lives and career, and most of them never ever have the opportunity to teach their subjects.
For Jakob, himself an immigrant from Hungary, the idea was inspired by an experience familiar to just about anyone who's ever been a tourist.
You sit in a cab and turns out that your driver is a poet, or your server at the restaurant is a scientist from another corner of the world.
But as a classroom, a taxi turns out to have a lot of advantages. In the open field, tents are set up to block the summer sun, with a couple dozen fold-up chairs as seating. Today's professors, who come from Pakistan, El Salvador, and Haiti, also must cope with the noise of planes overhead.
Another airplane.
In addition to the language barrier.
Hello, everyone. Thank you all for joining us. So we have here Kenrick, and I'm sorry, I'm going to say your last name incorrectly, Demesvar.
But no one complains. Kenrick Demesvar is here to talk about the history and conservation of Sanssouci Palace, the only UNESCO World Heritage Site in his native country of Haiti. Demesvar came to the U.S. after earning a PhD in cultural anthropology, looking for a job at a university. That was 5 years ago, and he feels like...
I'm still in a transitional period. As a teacher, I need to continue to teach because it's my vocation. So nowadays, I'm a substitute teacher, working mostly in charter school for elementary and high school students.
But Demesvar never stopped looking for opportunities to get back to doing what he loves. And that's meant looking beyond LinkedIn.
When I realized that this event was taking place here, I thought it was like an opportunity also to network with other people in the same field.
If you have a problem with my hard accent, you can stop me. I'm going to repeat with you.
On the other side of the park, Nadia Bokhari, a journalist originally from Pakistan, is here to talk about the origin of Islam. She feels like Americans' views of Islam have been distorted by coverage of radical clerics and terrorists. And she has another mission, to eradicate the word Islamophobia.
So the term Islamophobia, I don't know who created this word, because the word Islamophobia, Islam means peace. So if you are going to translate this word, it's a weird translation, like peace phobia. Who says peace phobia?
The library is trying to spread the message about peace phobia, but also the need for jobs, by bringing HR people from local universities and teacher training colleges to sit in on open-air lectures. With registration already full for most classes this summer, Jakob Orzo says they are planning a winter semester, this time indoors. The Help Wanted sign is staying up. Recently, Jakob says he interviewed an immigrant from Russia, now working as a baker, who wants to teach philosophy.
When he came to the interview, his hands were all doughy. And we immediately, in 10 minutes, we were talking about subjects, like serious philosophical subjects. And having a baker explaining with his hands gesticulating, it just put the entire thing in different perspective.
The baker is Pavel Illin, and he got the job. According to the online course catalog, his class will address challenging limitations, overcoming fears, exploring the nature of the universe, and the endless attempts we make to define who we are. For The World, this is Alina Simone in Brooklyn.
Think about all the stuff that gets posted online every day. You know, puppies and kitties snuggling, 85-year-olds dancing their hearts out. Of course, not all of it's cute. There are violent videos, hate speech, racists trying to get attention. Sifting through those posts and identifying whether they need to come down, some of it's done by sophisticated technology, some of it by humans working for Facebook, Twitter, and other platforms. Most of the work, though, is outsourced, left to content moderators working for third-party companies. And those moderators can be located everywhere from Germany to the Philippines. Sarah T. Roberts is a professor at UCLA and writes about all of this in her new book, Behind the Screen: Content Moderation in the Shadows of Social Media.
One of the reasons for the work being done outside the U.S. is simply for the fact that the population of social media platforms is largely outside the U.S. So obviously, having moderators who can be steeped in the cultural and linguistic context of a particular place becomes very important. But that's only one of the reasons. The other one, of course, is a bit more worrisome, and it has to do with very low labor cost, often poor labor protections, and the availability of a needy pool of workers.
Yeah, I mean, you've described some of the things that content moderators have to look at as humanity's worst expression of itself. I mean, what kind of things are content moderators exposed to?
One of the best ways to know the material that these moderators see on a daily basis is if you look at the community guidelines or standards on a given site about what's prohibited. So that might be violent videos, videos of people being killed, video that's coming from war zone, material that depicts child sexual exploitation. It's pretty dire out there. And one of my worries is not only are the support systems in place for people who are on the job right now somewhat lacking and inadequate in many cases, but we don't really have a sense or understand what the long-term implications of looking at that kind of stuff day in and day out will be a year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years down the road.
Sarah, you spent a lot of time, a good decade, thinking about and documenting the issues that come up with human content moderation, which has, as you've been describing, its own set of problems. Are there any viable alternatives? Like, does artificial intelligence technology provide some solutions?
For some of the worst, these computational tools do help and do work. But from the words of industry insiders themselves, they have told me there's really no foreseeable future when we're going to see the human actors kind of removed from that production chain. I think we'd be wary to turn the keys fully over to computers in this case anyway.
So your research for this book began in 2010, and since then a number of countries have come up with proposals or passed laws to penalize companies that don't quickly remove hate speech and other harmful content. Germany is one example. How are these laws and regulations changing the content moderation landscape? Are they?
They certainly are. I mean, they are having a huge impact. In the case of Germany, the response was an entire call center was built out in Berlin by a third party to respond to the particular needs and mandates of that German law. So I think we're going to see more and more cases like that.
So moving from behind the screen to in front of the screen, now that you know what goes on with content moderation, how has that impacted the way you engage with social media and any other digital platforms, both in professional and your personal life?
That's a great question. You know, I've been on the internet for almost 30 years as a user of the social internet. And so I'm certainly not a Luddite, and I'm certainly not advocating that we all get off these platforms. But I think for me personally, I've certainly narrowed my presence online to maybe just a couple of platforms. When I encounter something disturbing, which I do, or inappropriate, and I go to flag that material as abusive or needing review, I always think about the person that's going to receive that report and know that I'm a part of the same cycle that I've tried to document over this past decade. It starts with me in a way.
Do you think firms like Facebook and Twitter have really done enough to moderate the content? Because, I mean, we keep hearing about cases where the content is really harsh and it doesn't get taken down. It's not even addressed.
I think the issue is one of scale. Basically, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, all of the platforms that we could name, there aren't really enough people in the world to be moderating all that material all the time. This is why computational tools become important. But that said, there will always be something that makes it through. There will always be a disturbing thing that people see. And part of that is where we have to take responsibility as a society for what we are producing and then uploading to the platforms as well. I also think we need to think about the way in which our behavior has become, in effect, monetized by these platforms who solicit all this material all the time. Unless that business model changes, this will continue to be a major problem for the platforms going forward.
Sarah T. Roberts at UCLA. She is the author of Behind the Screen, which is out today. Sarah, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
The current confrontation with Iran all comes back to nukes and the 2015 deal that effectively put Tehran's nuclear program in check to delay the possibility that Iran could acquire nuclear weapons. The agreement did that by, among other things, limiting how much uranium Iran could enrich. And even when the Trump administration pulled out of the deal last year, Iran stayed in full compliance. But that's now changing. Iran says its growing stockpile of low-enriched uranium will breach the limits it agreed to this Thursday. So does this mean Iran is back on track to build a nuclear bomb, and how long would that take? Joe Cirincione is an expert in nuclear deterrence. He's the head of the Plowshares Fund in Washington. How quickly could Iran collect enough enriched uranium for a bomb, Joe?
The deal was designed to keep Iran at least a year away from a bomb, as compared to a few weeks before the deal. So as long as Iran stays within the limits, it would take it at least a year to make enough material for the core of one bomb, and we believe about another year to fashion that material into an actual deliverable warhead. That will start to change as they breach the limits.
And how much is that going to change? Does Iran have the technological capacity to do it fast, do it faster than, say, 2 years?
This is a very measured response by Iran to what they see as this economic warfare by the United States. So this is not a nuclear crisis yet. They're not sprinting towards a bomb. This isn't a full breakout scenario. Let me explain why. Before the deal, they had about 10,000 kilograms of low-enriched uranium gas, 10,000 kilograms of that. The deal made them ship almost all of that, 98%, out of the country. They were left with a token amount of 300 kilograms. That's the limit they're now threatening to breach. But even if they went to 400 kilograms, say, and that would take them weeks or even months to do, that's still not enough to make a bomb. You need about 1,000 kilograms of low-enriched uranium gas to make enough material, 25 kilograms, of highly enriched uranium, the stuff you can turn into a metal and turn into a bomb. So they're a long way away.
So you call this a measured response, but it's measured by their own capabilities. Like, how quickly would the outside world even know if Iran suddenly made a dash for the bomb?
This is the good news. We would know immediately. We have exquisite intelligence on what Iran is doing for two reasons. One, the deal imposed the most intrusive inspection regime in the planet. We have international atomic energy inspectors there. We have cameras. We have SEALs. Wax on cylinder Game of Thrones seals. I mean, fiber optic radio frequency seals. If they breach a limit, if they start moving centrifuges out of storage and put them online, we will know instantly. Plus, we have our own intelligence and the intelligence of many of our allies, including Israel, Germany, etc. We'll know exactly what they're doing.
Are the nuclear inspections in Iran ongoing, even with the U.S. out of the deal? And is that expected to continue even after Thursday when they breach this enriched uranium bar?
Yes, and it would be a completely different situation if they were pulling out of the deal entirely, if they were pulling Saddam Hussein and kicking out inspectors. They're not. That's what I mean by a measured response. The deal is still alive. That is, Russia, China, the European Union, all the European countries who negotiated the deal, they're still complying with it, and so is Iran up to this point. It's the U.S. who back in May of 2018 pulled out of the deal. Well, actually not pulled out. There is no withdrawal mechanism. Technically, we are violating the deal. We promised to lift the sanctions. We are violating the deal by putting those sanctions back in place. What Iran is basically saying is, look, for a year, you've been violating the deal, and we've been keeping with it. Now we're going to show you that there's a cost to your U.S. violations. We're going to start lifting some of the limitations on us, too. So far, measured. They're threatening to do one other step, and just in announcements today, and they may do that, which is also to raise the enrichment level of the uranium they are enriching. So they're limited by the deal to just basically 3.5%, the level you would use for nuclear fuel in their reactor. But they used to have a stockpile of 20% enriched, and they may be going to do that too. That is a material that brings you much closer to bomb grade, which is roughly 90%. It would again shorten the time to which they could break out and sprint to a bomb. It would still be months. We would still see them doing it, but they'd be getting closer.
How do you read these actions by Iran, Joe Cirincione? Is it saber-rattling, or is it kind of just finding pressure where they've got room to kind of maneuver?
It's not saber-rattling because they're not threatening to go to war. This is aimed at the Europeans more than the U.S. The Europeans promised Iran that if they stayed in the deal, which they have, that Iran would find a way around the U.S. sanctions. Remember, Iran is not enjoying the benefits it was promised under the deal. Their economy is getting crushed, not improving. So the Europeans have promised to implement what they call a special vehicle, a mechanism for allowing European and Asian countries to get around the sanctions. They haven't done it yet. This is a step by Iran to put pressure on the Europeans to get them to provide some of the economic benefits they were promised.
And yet, despite the deal, clearly Iran sees that nuclear deterrence works. They have the example of North Korea, which called America's bluff last year. That example has to be influencing Iran.
It does, and it certainly did. And that, I think, is why they were exploring the idea of a bomb in the first place under the guise of a civilian program. I mean, you know, I think we all should recognize that Iran was on the pathway to a bomb. They did not have an organized nuclear weapons program. Our intelligence agency says that effort ended in 2003. So when John Bolton says, as he did today, that they want to end Iran's nuclear weapons program, well, he's a little late. That ended a long time ago. But by building up the capability, they certainly get to the threshold. And that's what worried us. The difference between North Korea and Iran is that North Korea has weapons. They have 20 to 30 nuclear weapons, several of which could probably reach us. Iran is years away from that kind of capability.
Joe Cirincione, president of the Plowshares Fund in Washington, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
There are a few styles of music I turn to when I need to dial back the stress of the day's news. Brazilian Bossa Nova is one, and there's a lot of great Bossa Nova to choose from. Here's a new entry. His name is simply Cessa, a young artist from Sao Paulo.
Sabe, pela pele a minha crença, a casa é a flor do real, a casa é a flor do real.
Even the title of this song by Cessa is soothing, Flor do Real, Royal Flower. Cessa might not think of his music as pure bossa nova. On this track, he throws in a horn section that runs somewhat off-kilter to the beat. But stay with Cessa's voice and guitar on his debut album, and I can almost guarantee your day will be relieved of any pressure. These days, that's about all I can guarantee. Marco Werman here saying goodbye until tomorrow. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. Thanks for being with us.
Deixa minha mão morar nas suas pernas e o meu quadril anexo ao seu.
PRI, Public Radio International.